Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. On Monday's show, we talked to the writer of the New York Times Magazine cover story this week about the shocking child and maternal death rates among African Americans compared to whites, even today in 21st century America. Yesterday, the city of New York removed a statue of a doctor from Fifth Avenue along Central Park because of that person's treatment of enslaved African American women in the 19th century.
Na, 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 na. Hey, goodbye.
That sound from the removal yesterday outside the Academy of Medicine at Fifth Avenue around 103rd Street. Dr. James Marion Sims was such a leading physician in his day that he became president of the American Medical Association. He was also credited with being ahead of most of his peers as an advocate of good health care for women and founded the institution known as the Woman's Hospital here in New York. He's been called the father of modern gynecology. But that was after Sims, who was from the South and was pro-slavery, performed a series of very painful experimental surgeries only on enslaved women in Alabama from 1845 to 1849 to develop a surgical treatment for a horrible condition called vesicovaginal fistula, an awful complication of obstructed labor during childbirth in some women in which a hole develops to the bladder, causing continual incontinence. Here is NYU historian Jennifer Morgan, happy about yesterday's removal at the scene.
He would operate on one woman with the help of the other, and then once that woman had healed, she would then be forced to help him perform these surgeries.
The city's Public Design Commission, created by Mayor de Blasio, voted unanimously on Monday to remove the Sims statue and relocate it to Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, where his remains are buried. It's the first such removal the commission has approved. Obviously, the women's ability to give informed consent was an issue because they were enslaved. So is the fact that no anesthesia was used, and the economic motivation for the slave owners' interests in having Sims try to cure their so-called property. Sims does have his defenders, though, and we'll touch on that too. But here's Mayor de Blasio pretty much forecasting what his Public Design Commission would find on this program back on January 12th.
There were many, many factors I think the commission looked at there, including obviously a horrible and painful choice of this individual to experiment on slave women without their consent. The deep concern in the surrounding community, which is largely a community of color, the fact that it was located at a place where there's supposed to be a broader celebration of medical science, and this was a very bad example of that, and that there was an alternative site to try and respect the fact that there were also contributions that this individual made to science. So that one was, I think, very particular and very specific. But again, the additive reality is to come up with something on that site that speaks to a more positive reality. And I think that was about the specifics of that site.
Mayor de Blasio here in January. We'll let our guests pick up the story from there. With me now are Harriet Washington, medical ethicist and author of books including Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, and Baron Lerner, MD and medical ethicist at NYU and author of books including The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. Baron and Harriet, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Harriet, you wrote about J. Marion Sims in your book more than a decade ago. What was your take on his legacy?
Well, my take on his legacy is that Sims was typical of his time. The things he did were certainly unacceptable then as they are now, but he's important because he is so typical. The work he did, the way he abused women of color was consonant with the typical practice of his time. And I just want to offer one little correction, which
sure.
Actually is significant, and that is that we're not talking about informed consent. informed consent is not the issue here. There was no informed consent practice during Sims' time. But simple consent, the ability to say yes or no to a procedure, was what was at issue here, which was universally held out to people who were esteemed, you know, white people, especially white people of property, but withheld from African Americans universally.
I'm curious to hear from each of you, how much did you find the Sims story cut and dried from a medical ethics standpoint, and how complicated? Harriet, you want to continue?
Sure. One can always find complexities, but the question is, how significant are the complexities? And the reality is not very, because the basic abuses were just that, quite basic. The Nuremberg Code says the voluntary consent of the subject is absolutely essential. It's a dividing line between the criminal and the acceptable. And it was also the dividing line during Sims' time. One always asked permission, although one did not do as doctors do today and give a great deal of information about the studies that you're performing, but you had to get a yes or no. But with enslaved people, their consent was not necessary. You obtain consent from the owner of the enslaved person. And that is the basic abuse from which a lot of the others are predicated. That was the most important thing. When you have an enslaved person whose status precludes consent, you can't give consent if you're enslaved and operating daily under the threat of torture, including medical torture, if you're operating under constraints on your autonomy. You know, they didn't have the right to say yes or no, and that was a basic problem. Of course, the other problem is that they were treated differently than white people were generally in terms of withholding anesthesia for reasons that were racialized, clearly racialized, according to the writings of the physicians of their time. They didn't believe that black people felt pain the way that whites do. And frankly, we still don't believe that black people feel pain the same way that whites do. Our practices today and studies today carry that out.
Baron, same question.
You know, I think we think about the ethics here, and it is pretty clear cut. Let's just remind ourselves what we're talking about. These are operations on women that are very invasive, that involve no anesthesia. They were most likely done for the benefit of the slave owners as much as the women themselves. And they were repeated over and over and over. That's bad ethics. That's bad medicine. And what's very important to note is that some people might say, well, it was a different time. It was a time of slavery. This was in the South. Sims was criticized at the time for doing this. And everybody knew that he was doing these operations on these women with no anesthesia. And so I think from an ethical perspective, it's worthy of great condemnation.
There have been some defenders of Sims. I read an article in the Journal of Medical Ethics from 2006 that argued that while he did perform the surgeries at first on enslaved women only, evidence suggests the women suffering from the fistulas wanted the surgery, and Sims once wrote that he only performed the surgery with consent, and that anesthesia was not routinely used on anyone at that time, including by Sims in his later surgeries on white women for the same condition. Do either of you have a take on the accuracy of those historical claims? Baron, you first?
Yeah, I've seen those writings as well. In other places, Sims writes about, admits to the pain and suffering that the women are going through under anesthesia, this without the anesthesia. So, you know, I think when you look back over time and you see a procedure that was done that ultimately did generate success, and especially if you're writing this as a surgeon, as the writer you're citing, who goes to Africa and does this surgery on women, it's more likely that you're going to look back fondly at the doctor who invented the operation that you can now use to help people. But I think if you look at the situation at the time, what was done to these women was brutal.
And Harriet, I guess you were already kind of answered the question about the consent part. Consent could not have been informed, but anything you want to add?
Yes. I want to add that the basis for claiming the women had offered their consent was Sims' own self-serving accounts, which he made after he had been criticized. And we have to consider the credibility of that claim. in light of his other work. Now, in the voluminous writings of Sims and about Sims during the time that I have read, I found not only that some of his contemporaries, like Dr. Daniel Hill Williams and others, criticized him, but I also found that Sims actually boasted. He voluntarily spoke of compelling African Americans to undergo experimental procedures. He didn't only operate on these women. He operated on newborns, but only black newborns, in which case he took shoemaker's tools to their skulls in an attempt to separate the bones, an experimental attempt to address their neonatal tetanus. And but before he did this, he took care to take them out of their mother's view. So that tells us it was not consensual. He did not get the mother's permission. Of course, he didn't have to get the mother's permission. And of course, it was not typical to get. In fact, it was very unusual, if ever, that the permission of a slave was sought. One enslaved man who refused permission adamantly and vehemently, Sims addressed this by having the man tied to a barber's chair and forcibly operated to remove his jaw. And he wrote in his medical journal of how, despite the fact that the enslaved man was screaming and trying to get away, he had proven that he could do a procedure whether the subject was willing or not. That shows us. These historical facts from Sims' own writings show us in what little regard he took, he held the consent of these women. So I don't think his claims are credible.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the City of New York's Public Design Commission, created by Mayor de Blasio, voting unanimously on Monday for the first time to remove a statue, the one of Dr. James Marion Sims on Fifth Avenue near the Academy of Medicine along Central Park, because of the acts from the past that we're hearing about from historians and ethicists Harriet Washington and Baron Lerner. We can take your phone calls on aspects of this, not just Sims' legacy. The commission voted unanimously, and we're hearing what we're hearing, but also the larger context, medicine today, what should come next at that site, any of these things. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Baron, I see the city is commissioning something new for that spot along Fifth Avenue, and I also see that three first names of enslaved women who Sims operated on are still known: Lucy, Anarka, and Betsy. Should they be memorialized, or should the city do something else? Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, it would be nice to do something to honor those women for many reasons. Obviously, they, without their ability to refuse, put their bodies online for scientific advancement. In addition, Sims himself has been lauded at that particular site for so many years without any concern for these women at all. So I know there have been various proposals to put, for example, statues of those women at that site or something. I think you don't want to just see them as victims by doing that. But I think something that would recognize the contributions of women, of African Americans, to the history of human experimentation done in an educational way could go a long way toward rectifying some of the problems that exist because the Sims statue was there for so long.
Harriet, same question.
I have a. I think there are many people who could be lauded, who could be honored, but I think the perfect candidate is James McCoon Smith, a very important African-American physician, the first African-American to earn an MD, who had to go to Glasgow, Scotland in order to earn it because medical schools barred him. It was a nakedly racial bar. They would not accept him because he was black. When he went to Glasgow, he was valedictorian at the medical school. When he returned here to New York City, he devoted himself to using his skills as a physician and also as a statistician, because he had gotten a PhD instead in that field at Glasgow as well, to refute scientific racism, the tenets that enabled enslavement and medical torture in the context of enslavement, making him a very important a medical figure. Also, Dr. Sims was the lion of the New York Academy of Medicine. I'm a fellow there now myself, but he he would basically ruled the Academy. He was thought of very highly there, very influential, used the Academy as his bully pulpit. When Dr. McCune Smith applied for membership, he applied to be a fellow. And they asked him to withdraw his application. He refused, and then they decided they were not going to act on it. So he was never admitted to fellowship. I would love to see him admitted to fellowship. I would love to see a statue to him because he was a very important abolitionist and a very important figure in terms of refuting the scientific pseudoscientific claims mm-hmm. that supported enslavement and supported claims of black inferiority. That's my candidate.
Thank you for telling that story. Let's take a phone call from Emily in Southern Maryland. Emily, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm thankful to the two people speaking today about putting the historic context on this statue. My question is about the kind of thoughts about the relocation of the statue to Greenwood Cemetery. I'm wondering, I haven't heard anything about if the commission is planning on providing any kind of support for the recontextualization, conservation, or reinterpretation of the statue in that setting. Greenwood is also a site that is interpreting history for a public audience. And in some ways, this seems like a kind of notion of taking the statue out of Manhattan and therefore out of the public eye. But in fact, it's still going to be someone's kind of responsibility to interpret it within a site. And so I think that could be a possibility for conversation, too, or even, you know, what does it mean to sort of move it to this other location? And I would love for the commission not just to say, yes, we're happy to take it down from its present place and put it somewhere else, but to actually have support and ideas for making that a kind of meaningful move rather than just a sort of out of sight, out of mind. Thanks very much.
Emily, thank you so much. Either of you want to react to that?
Sure. My understanding is that there's going to be at least some type of a plaque and other educational materials at Greenwood Cemetery, which is great, because putting on my historian hat for a second, it would be a shame if the Sims statue is moved out of Manhattan and everybody stops thinking about it. I mean, it's nice that it's not there anymore, and it's nice he's not being celebrated, but it's still a teachable moment. Why was it in Manhattan for so long? Why did people put it up? Why did it have to get moved? This is a great opportunity for people who visit Greenwood to visit the statue and read about it and learn about the sort of racist environment in this country that permitted Sims to be celebrated for so long. So I think it's a great opportunity.
Mary in Inwood, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mary.
Hi, Brian. I'm overlooking beautiful Inwood Park right this minute. And I wanted to say that, especially in light of your commenter's last remarks, taking the statue down and moving it to Brooklyn and adding a little explanatory plaque really doesn't do the job. J. Marion Sims was an important historical figure. He was honored at the time. He's connected to the New York Academy of Medicine. And why are we running away from history? We're losing something enormous in trying to edit our history to meet today's standards. And I'm very sorry to see it go.
Thank you very much. What about this notion of presentism, Harriet, that Mary brings up?
Yeah, if I may, I think that's an important point that she brings up. And I want to point out that, first of all, statues are not historical documents. Moreover, this statue has something in common with the statues of Confederate generals, in that often these statues are monuments to people who the prevailing power structure wishes to honor. And as such, this statue is a symbol of racial power. If you want to learn history, read a book. There are resources set out for it. The statues don't exist to educate people about history. They exist to exert power over communities, reminders of who basically is in power and who can compel. And one little brief parenthetical note. It was mentioned that statues haven't been removed before, but if I recall correctly, the much-hated civic virtue statue was indeed removed as a result of community pressure before Dr. Sims. So, and I think that the last caller, I'd like to point out to her that we are addressing history. We're correcting it.
How do you, and we have a few other callers who are not going to have time to take on the air, asking some version of how do you take the legacy of the whole person into account in this case, considering what he went on to do for women in general medically? I gather that that kind of post-childbirth fistula became a thing of the past in the Western world as a result of Sims surgical techniques, and there was the Woman's Hospital in New York, I guess considered a historic boon to women's health and something that he was devoted to. Baron, how would you answer the question that people are raising about the whole person?
Well, I like to teach my students that history is messy. You're rarely going to get people who are pure heroes or pure villains. And Sims did do some things that turned out to be very prescient and very important in the history of gynecology. The problem is how he did it. So what we're struggling with is the fact that we have celebrated this really uncritically for too long. So now I think we're putting better context in this, and we can still acknowledge what he did accomplish, but put a cautionary note on that, that the way he did it, that the end shouldn't justify the means. And so that is, I think, an important part of his historical legacy.
Harriet, anything in addition?
I couldn't agree more, Baron, but I also want to add that, as I said at the beginning, Sims is important because of how typical he is. And he is also typical in that it represents a flaw in how we decide who our medical heroes are. We have historically decided that people who achieve great things, or are we assume have achieved great things. I'm not certain that Sims was as influential as you say, but we've assumed that, as you said, the ends justify the means, a consequentialist importance. You know, if you do something important, it doesn't really matter how you do it. That's a flaw in our thinking. That's a flaw in our ethical analyses. We need, when I look back over history, I see many, many people who have been erected as medical heroes and praised, and they have feet of clay. In my view, they're not heroes because of how they conducted themselves, how they predicated their advances. And very often, we can't forget, medicine has a lot of mythologies. So sometimes we are admiring people for achievements that were not exactly theirs. So I think that's really important to realize that we have to rethink what we're going to include when we decide someone's a hero. Are we going to include their character and behavior as well as their supposed achievements?
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We have a few minutes left with medical ethicists and historians Harriet Washington and Baron Lerner on the city's first act of taking down a statue because of things that that person did in the past. Dr. James Marion Sims from outside the Academy of Medicine along Fifth Avenue above 100th Street in Central Park. And Anne in Nyack. You're on WNYC. Hello, Anne.
Oh, hi. I wanted to call to tie this discussion into the guest you had yesterday who wrote the New York Times article about Black women's mortality and infant mortality in this country, and how I think that there's another legacy to Sims besides his achievements in the surgical procedures that he created, but also that there's a legacy that continues in obstetrics and gynecology in particular, because all the patients are women, which is a lack of consent and informed consent and education and respect for patients that I think is another legacy of his and of the beginnings of gynecology. In my own experience, when I had a birth plan and a doula and was having twins, I experienced an obstetrician throwing the birth plan out the window, inviting 20 medical students and residents in to observe while he attempted a breech extraction, which involved putting his hands inside my uterus without my consent. And when I screamed, he stopped, and I was allowed to deliver naturally. But it's not uncommon. And speaking with doulas and midwives and counselors afterwards, I realized how common it is for obstetricians and gynecologists to disregard their patients in the way that Sims did.
Anne, thank you very much. And I'm sorry that you went through what you went through. So to our guests, how would you answer Anne's question about tying that past to the present. You know, I was wondering if removing the statue can accomplish things in addition to resetting who society deems worthy of such an honor. Because I was also thinking about our segment on Monday, and, you know, a lot of our listeners probably read that New York Times Magazine cover story on the shocking and ongoing racial disparities in maternal and child death rates from pregnancy or childbirth. Can the statue removal do any good or be seen in the context of a larger effort to do some good for the present or future in this respect, Baron?
Of course it can. Again, I encourage us to think historically. When we look back at Sins, we try to understand what was going on in his era and what it was historically that would have made him do what he did. And we look at our era, and things are obviously not going to be the same as Sims. There's consent forms. The world is very different. There's so many more women in gynecology, women of color. But that doesn't mean that some of the issues involved, like respecting patients and issues of racism and issues of sexism, still don't exist in our society. So the history is a good reminder that these complicated issues don't go away over time. They're just reframed.
Harriet, you get the last word in this segment. What would you like to add to that?
I think that we have to remember, thinking historically, as Baron rightfully suggests, that Sims had theories about vesico-vaginal fistula. Essentially, he blamed women for their own conditions. Of course, he was wrong. It was actually a feature of certain social pressures and malnutrition that caused black women to have higher rates. But he said it was their behavior, their lascivious behavior, and their lack of hygiene. I think that attitude ties in with what this last caller has referred to, a certain failure of respect. And I think that that's something that is changing, has changed dramatically, and that's a good thing. I'm not inclined to tie it to the statue's removal. I am inclined to tie it to people's unwillingness to accept medical mythologies, without analyzing them any longer. We can't simply, accept the assessment that women have been responsible for their own ailments, that it's appropriate to force certain procedures on women because it's for their own good without asking their permission. We know now that that's not acceptable. We knew then, too, but we now know that's not acceptable for anyone, and I think that's a very important advance.
Harriet Washington, medical ethicist and historian and author of books including Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, and Baron Lerner, medical ethicist and historian and internist at NYU, and author of books including The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and The Evolution of Medical Ethics. Thank you both so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.